Okay, good evening, and welcome to our 20-lesson series. This is supposed to be the entire Jewish history in 1 hour. We'll see if we manage that, or if this becomes the entire Jewish history in 2 hours done in two installments. That is a possibility as well. Let's see how this turns out. Let's just begin by quoting from Deuteronomy, chapter 32, verse 7. Remember the days of old, understand the years of generation after generation, ask your father and he will relate to you, your elders and they will tell you. In other words, it almost seems as if we have an explicit commandment or obligation to learn our history, and that's what we're going to do tonight. As the book of Genesis relates it, Adam was created and Eve were created on the sixth day of creation, in the process of creation, more than 5,780 years ago. Just so we understand, the year 2000 is equivalent to the year 5760 in the Hebrew calendar. And the biblical narrative describes, now reconciling that with science is a different idea. How, you know, was the first human being really created 5,780 years ago? How that reconciles with science, we definitely know how to do that. But that's not our topic for now. We are going to talk about history. So the biblical narrative describes how there's a spiritual decline for more than a millennia and a half, for more than 1,500 years. Until we get to the story of the flood with Noah. God decides to destroy the world with a flood. Noah lives, Noah and his family. They go on an ark, very simple. The basic idea is after the story of Noah, you would have hoped that humanity would have improved. Not necessarily. You have the story of the Tower of Babel, where humanity unites for all the wrong reasons, to rebel against God, basically. And then comes onto the scene about 3,700 years ago was Abraham, who was virtually the only person who believed in one God, or specifically this ethical monotheism that he perpetuated. Takes place around the 18th century BC, or as I said, 3,700 years ago. Now, before we go on at all, don't make the mistake that the Bible is a history book. And let's talk about what that means for just a moment. We are first introduced to Abraham, one of the most important people in our history, when he's 75 years old. If it was in fact a history book, we would have been told about the early life of Abraham and so on and so forth. He's one of the most significant figures in Jewish history, and we don't hear anything about him until he is already an elderly man, an older man. So certainly we can learn about our history from the Torah, from the Bible, but that doesn't mean that the Bible is set up as a history book. The Hebrew word for the Bible is Torah, which means education, which means to teach. It's here to teach us lessons, and sometimes we will learn history through that. We also have the big discussion about, is the Torah really an historical document? Remember the same week you had an Israeli newspaper, Haaretz, talking about how the Bible is definitely not historically accurate. And then at the same week you had an article in U.S. News and World Report. It was a cover story supporting the accuracy of the Bible vis-a-vis archaeology. So that's another very important discussion, which we're not going to get into right now. Exactly. Now, Abraham appears at a period of time commonly known as the Middle Bronze Period. We have to understand early civilizations are characterized by the metals that they predominantly used, and the Middle Bronze Period of the Near or the Middle East covers the period of time from 2200 BC until 1550 BC. And Abraham is introduced to us in a very interesting land. We see this land change hands many times, and a huge number of civilizations in this part of the world occupy this land. So you have Assyrians, Babylonians, Persians, Greeks, Romans, and then, of course, Muslims. And it's in this tumultuous place where Jewish history begins, at the bottom of the Tigris and Euphrates River, in the cradle of civilization. It made sense that Judaism was going to start here because this was the cradle of civilization. This was This was the center of civilization at the time, the Promised Land, Mesopotamia, whatever you want to call it right now. But it makes sense that this is where Avram's going to first appear, Abraham's going to appear, because if his destiny is to change the world, he has to be at the center of civilization. After he arrives in the Promised Land together with his wife, Sarah, he is faced with a dilemma because Sarah is not able to have children, and she wants Abraham to have offspring. So he takes as a surrogate wife by the name of Hagar. Hagar traditionally is the daughter of the Pharaoh, of the Egyptian Pharaoh at the time. And she travels together with Abraham and Sarah of her own volition. She wants to be part of that group family. And so Abraham takes Hagar as a surrogate wife, and they have a child. That child's name is Yishmael or Ishmael. And Islam is a religion that originated with the Arab peoples more than 1,300 years ago. But according to their own tradition and our tradition, the Muslim community are descendants of Yishmael, which means that you had two of the greatest cultures, heritages, faiths in the world, in the history of the world, that stemmed from Abraham. Which brings us to Abraham's second child, who is Isaac, the child that he has with it as he gets very old, and so is his wife Sarah. They have a child, Isaac. Isaac becomes the next line in the forefathers of the Jewish people. He marries Rebecca. She becomes the second matriarch of the Jewish people. They have twins. Their twins' names are Jacob and Esau, or Yaakov and Esav. We are told Yaakov ends up becoming the third patriarch of the Jewish people, the third generation. Esav, who is older than Yaakov, and there's a whole story about the blessings, which we're not going to get into right now. But one thing to keep in mind is that Esav has a grandson by the name of Amalek. And we will hear about Amalek a lot throughout Jewish history, because Amalek is the arch nemesis of the Jewish people. And Amalek rears its head in many different ways through many different cultures. We understand that the Romans come from Amalek, so on and so forth. But again, that is not for right now. Yaakov, the third patriarch of the Jewish people, he goes down to Haran. He has to escape his brother's wrath. And he goes down to a cousin, Lavan, who is his, actually it's his uncle, his mother, Rebecca, Rivka's, brother. And the first person that he encounters is his cousin, Rachel or Rachel. He wants to marry her. Lavan tricks him into marrying his older daughter first, which is Leah. He ends up marrying Rachel, Leah, and each one of their maidservants, who are Bilhah and Zilpah, and together they have 13 children, 12 sons and one daughter. These 12 sons form the 12 tribes. Again, the future, the source of the lineage of the future Jewish people. Specifically, let's focus in on Joseph, who is the older son of from Rachel. He is the most beloved son of Yaakov's, and he ends up in Egypt. He causes a lot of animosity grows between him and his other brothers. He ends up being sold into slavery in Egypt and as a servant in Egypt. Eventually, he interprets the dreams of the Pharaoh and becomes the viceroy of Egypt, saves Egypt from famine. During that famine, the brothers who are currently living in the land of Israel come down to Egypt because they are suffering from the famine, and the only place that you can get some sort of sustenance is by going down to Egypt. Eventually, Yosef reveals himself to his brothers who they are, who he is. It's a big reunion. Yaakov and the entire family come down to Egypt. They come down to Egypt as 70 individuals, Jacob and his family, Jacob, his 12 sons, their wives, and their children. This is the proto-Jewish nation, and they arrive in Egypt. And at the end of the book of Genesis, the first book of the Torah, of the Bible, it ends with the deaths of Jacob and Joseph, Yaakov and Yosef. At that point, everything is still okay, but then we open up the second book of the Torah, the second book of the Bible, which is Exodus, Shmos, and we hear a new story. At this point in time, when the Exodus story begins, as I said, the family of 70 individuals that arrived in Egypt at the time of Joseph has now grown to a nation of almost of millions of people. And this is when, and at this point is when the Pharaoh enslaves the Jewish people. And why and how that happened is not for now. Moses is born to very illustrious parents. He ends up being raised in the palace of the Pharaoh. Again, a very interesting story. And just by the way, the events of the Exodus from Egypt, they happened around 1314 to 1313, right around there BC, if we translate Jewish chronology into the Christian dating system. Okay, that's what it would kind of turn out as. But basically, Moses ends up in Midian, which is across the Sinai Peninsula. There he meets his future father-in-law, Jethro. He marries one of his daughters, Zipporah. They have two sons. He becomes a shepherd. While he is a shepherd, he has a vision of a burning bush, which is his first prophetic experience, where God tells him, go and take my people out of the land of Egypt. And so he does. There's the 10 plagues, the splitting of the sea as they come out of Egypt. And it culminates 49 days after they come out of Egypt, at Mount Sinai, where the Jewish people receive the Torah. It's a totally unique event in all of human history. It's about 1300s BC. I think if you go according to Jewish chronology, it translates as 1312 BC. This is something that has never happened before, never happened again. Every man, woman, and child of the Jewish people had an encounter with God. Moses learned the Torah on Mount Sinai, brought down the Ten Commandments, transmitted the Torah. And when we talk about the Torah in Judaism, there's a written Torah and an oral Torah. The written Torah, the five books of Moses. The oral Torah is a tradition that explains and expounds on the five books of Moses that is passed down orally for many generations until it's finally written down, which we will get to in about 1,000 years from now. When Moses comes down from the Mount Sinai, he finds that the Jewish people are engaged in the worship of a golden calf. Moses breaks the tablets, and this infamous event is forever marked in the Hebrew calendar. 17th of Tammuz. The 17th of Tammuz becomes a terrible day throughout history. It would be the day later in history, and during which the walls of Jerusalem would be breached by both the Babylonians during the First Temple period and the Romans during the Second Temple period, both of those leading to the destruction of the First and Second Temple. Moses goes back up the mountain on the first of Elul, so not too long after that. Elul is the month before Rosh Hashanah. He comes back down with the second set of tablets on Yom Kippur, which is our Day of Atonement, so that all is very symmetrical, all lines up very beautifully. And as a sign of forgiveness, God tells Moshe that he will once again dwell among the Jewish people. And God instructs Moshe how to build God's home, which is called the Mishkan or the Tabernacle. They shall make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell among them. Exodus 25:8. There's many chapters dedicated to the intricate descriptions onto how to build this portable sanctuary. This structure, this Mishkan, became very important. This is where the divine presence rested. Without the Mishkan, without having the sanctuary, whether in the form of the Mishkan or later in the tabernacle or later in the form of the temple, only 369 of the 613 commandments are applicable, and most of those are negative commandments. In other words, many of our positive commandments are focused on how to use the sanctuary, how to use the Mishkan and then the temple, the tabernacle, then the temple, how to use it to connect to God. And the loss of that structure would have tremendous implications for the Jews. First and foremost, we have many less mitzvot to fulfill at this point in time. This sanctuary, which was assembled and then disassembled many times throughout the desert during the 40 years that the Jews were in the desert. So 369 of the, then we have for 440 years after the Jewish people entered the land of Israel, they actually used this sanctuary, this temporary tabernacle. That was before they conquered Jerusalem, before it was assembled in four different locations, and that was before we built the temple, which happened in 830. We're going to skip ahead for just a sec, just so that we can continue with the chronology of the sanctuary slash temple. In 832 BC, King Solomon builds the first temple in Jerusalem, and then it becomes the permanent sanctuary until it was destroyed by the Babylonians in 422. And then we have the second temple, and we will get to that. One other important thing to point out that happened during the time in the desert was the story of the 12 spies. When the Jewish people, prior to entering the land of Israel, they send spies. The spies come back with a negative report, convince the nation to basically lose faith in God. And this happens on the 9th, and at that point in time was the decree that all of these Jewish people that came into the desert will never leave the desert, and only the next generation will enter the land of Israel. This decree, this all happened on the 9th of Av. Again, that's the reason I'm sharing this is because of this date. The 9th of Av is one of the most significant and depressing dates in the Jewish calendar. Virtually every major disaster in Jewish history is going to be connected to the 9th of Av, which is the exact date when both the first and second temples are destroyed. Okay, now we are entering the land of Israel. At this point in time, the leadership transitions from Moses, from Moshe, to his closest student, Joshua or Yehoshua. And now, as far as the Torah is concerned as well, we have finished the five books of Moses, and now the narrative begins in the book of Joshua, which is part of the book, which is part of the prophets. Joshua leads the Jewish people for 28 years. The book of Joshua describes the 7 years of conquest and 7 years of settlement of the land of Israel. After the land is conquered and divided into separate tribal portions through a divinely guided lottery, that's the next part of the book of Joshua. And the book also describes the biblical boundaries of the land of Israel. At this point in time, now that when Joshua passes away, who now is the leaders of the Jewish people? You have the judges. They are leaders that arise during this time. They unify the people. They often get them to repent, deal with the spiritual problems of the nation, and also with physical threats. This is all accounted. This is all told over in the book of Judges, or Shoftim, that's authored by the last great personality in the period of the judges, who is Samuel the prophet, or Shmuel. The period of the judges spans a period of 365 years from the first judge to the last judge, again, who is Shmuel, who is the prophet Samuel. Samuel is one of the most important prophets in Jewish history, and he is famous for something very specific, and that is anointing the first two kings of Israel, King Saul and then King David. So what's the story behind the monarchy of the Jewish people? A delegation is dispatched to ask Samuel, the prophet, to anoint a king. And he was the leader for the past 13 years. He actually leads together with the king that he appoints for the next 2 years. When this delegation comes to Samuel, to Shmuel, he's not happy with this request. And he speaks to God about it, and God tells him to go ahead, even though God's self is also not very happy about this request either. As it says in Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people according to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from reigning over them." So in the year 884 BC, so now we're at 884, 393 years after the Jewish people first entered the land of Israel, King Saul is anointed as the first king by the prophet Samuel in accordance with the wishes of the people. And then after King Saul, then you have the next king. And we're not going to get to the story. We're not going to get into that story of how that transitioned. But now we have King David. King David is one of the most important figures in the Jewish history. Born in 907 BC, he reigns as the king of Israel for 40 years. He dies at age 70 in 837 BC. Now, during this time, the story of Israel during this time, from the Exodus onward, is the story of this tiny nation sandwiched between the two great ancient civilizations, Egypt and Mesopotamia, which was ruled, again, as I said, at various times by different nations. When David takes the throne, though, when King David takes the throne, Egypt and Assyria are both on a significant decline. It's not going to stay that way for a long time, but right now they are. They're not in a position to expand, which then leaves a vacuum in the middle where Israel is located, and Israel can basically expand without such problem by either of these great empires. So David, some of the things he does is he's able to subdue the Philistine threat to the Jewish people and conquer the remaining Canaanite city-state Jerusalem that the Israelites have thus far not been able to conquer. So he conquers Jerusalem. Now, just to remember, for the 440 years since from when the Jewish people first entered the land of Israel until the time of King David, Jerusalem has remained an unconquered non-Jewish city in the heart of a Jewish country, basically. It's a city-state inhabited by the Canaanite tribe called the Jebusites, the Yevusim, and it's heavily fortified. And David is finally able to conquer it, and the first thing he does after conquering it is he makes it his capital. He makes it the capital of his kingdom. And after he makes it the capital of his kingdom, he buys the upper part of the hill above the northern boundary of the city from its owner, a Jebusite as well. The purchase is recorded in the Bible in two places. This hill is what we believe to be Mount Moriah. And what it may lack in physical size, it more than compensates for in its spiritual greatness. Today on this spot stands an Islamic structure known as the Dome of the Rock. And this made a lot of sense to be the place where they would build a permanent resting spot for the most holy object that the Jewish people have, the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant. And King David wastes no time in doing so, bringing the Ark to Jerusalem. Then we hear a little bit about, there's a lot of narrative about King David. One thing that we have to mention is his wife Bathsheba. And together they have a child that doesn't survive, but they also have a child that does survive. And that child's name is Solomon. He's a golden child, gifted with unusual wisdom. Born in 848 BC, Solomon dies at a young age of 52 in 796. He also rules as king for 40 years, which are probably best known as the best years in Jewish history. 40 years of peace and prosperity. The Bible relates that kings from all over the world came to hear his wisdom, which included not only Torah wisdom, but wisdom in knowledge, all different types of areas of science and knowledge as well. And the crowning achievement of Solomon's reign is the building of the temple, which his father King David had dreamt about. Now King Solomon makes it a reality. And that's a huge thing for the Jewish people. They now have their temple in Jerusalem, a permanent structure that houses the divine presence. When King Solomon dies in 797-96, Israel is still a united country, a united people, but there is some tension between the north and the south. Following the death of King Solomon, his son Rehoboam becomes king. And in response to the political situation, he actually goes up north to Shechem or to Nablus to have himself crowned. But then in the year 796 BC, or very soon after, the northern tribes secede from the union, creating a new kingdom called Israel, which means that Rehoboam, the king, the son of King Solomon, he's left with just the southern part of the country, and Jerusalem, which includes Jerusalem. His kingdom is called Judah. And now you have a northern kingdom, which makes up 10 of the tribes of Israel, a much bigger group of people in the northern part of Israel, that is known as Samaria or the Shomron. And this split is very bad news. It's a disaster for many reasons, both spiritual and geopolitical. You had a once strong, unified nation, now is a weak, divided nation, and we will see it quickly falls prey. Not that quickly, but it falls prey to some pretty bad things. The king of the northern country, the northern part of the country, the northern kingdom, is Yeroboam, the son of Nevat. He is a great man, but power gets to his head. He sees that the Jewish people in the north are still very strongly connected to Jerusalem. So he hatches a scheme and he decides to set up an alternative place of worship in the north. He builds two temples, one in Beit El and one in Dan, where you can go to till today. And he says, this is your new temple. You no longer go down to the temple in Jerusalem. And not only does he make the two temples, he sets up guards and says that won't allow people to go to the southern temple. Not only does he do that, but he sets up golden calves in these temples and even uses the same language used in the golden calf story. And these become the temples of the northern kingdom, which is obviously a terrible thing that could happen to the Jewish people. In the next 240 years, there are 19 different kings of the northern kingdom of Israel, which is terrible. One is worse than the other. They are idolaters, corrupt and evil, and they lead the Jewish people into idolatry. The prophet of note at this time is Elijah or Eliyahu, the one that we invite to our seders and other times. The primary function of the prophets at this time is to really get the Jews of both Judah and Israel to turn away from idolatry and return to God. Elijah yearns to have the Jewish people repent. It doesn't happen exactly as Elijah wants it. And meanwhile, the Assyrians are becoming stronger. They are the inhabitants of modern-day Iraq. And as they become stronger, they begin to occupy the territory immediately north, Syria, Iraq, and Turkey. And now they want to continue to build their empire. Before we go on, I just want to say one little piece of information. You'll find that the dates of the Assyrian conquest do not match up with the Jewish dating that we will be talking about in this little class. And this is because in this class, I'm relying on the traditional Jewish dating system. And the traditional Jewish dating system and the Christian dating system, they can vary by as much as 164 years for the Assyrian, Babylonian, and Persian periods. But by the time we get to the Roman period, which is basically the Christian year one, this discrepancy disappears. Why and how, that's out of the purview of this class, but I just want to make sure that that is clear. Okay, so now we have the Assyrians. And the Assyrians do something interesting. As they conquer, they do something that never had before happened. They exile the conquered people. They take the indigenous people, move them someplace else, and bring others to take their place. And the point was, by the time the exiles figure out where they are, decades pass and they don't remember to rebel anymore, very simply. Now, starting around 575 BC, the Assyrians take over the lands that belong to the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali and exile them. Another Assyrian emperor takes over the land of the tribes of Reuven, Gad, and Manasseh and exiles them. 556 BC, another one completes the job, and now the whole northern part of the country ceases to exist as a Jewish state. What happens to these 10 tribes that are now exiled, according to Assyrian policy? They assimilate and are known today as the 10 lost tribes. We never hear from them again. Now the Jewish people are dispersed from the northern kingdom of Israel, and now, of course, the Assyrians want to get to the southern kingdom of Israel. But this does not prove so easily. The southern kingdom of Israel lasts almost 134 years longer than the northern kingdom. The mighty Assyrian army, they actually get pretty far through to the southern kingdom. They besiege the city and things begin to look pretty grim, but Isaiah the prophet assures the people that the city will not fall. And true to Isaiah's prophecy, a plague hits the Assyrian camp. Their army is decimated overnight, according to the prophet. And the Assyrians pack up and conquer the southern kingdom. In the meanwhile, the Assyrian Empire, which had become a great threat to Israel, is overrun by a new world power called Babylonia. And it is the Babylonians who now invade, about 100 years later, the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Judah. They march on Judah as part of their campaign to stake claim to the former Assyrian Empire. It is 434 BC, which is 11 years before the destruction of the first temple. Now, this is very interesting. The Babylonian aim is to impose their rule and basically make what remains of Israel as a vassal state. And they largely succeed. And they do something very interesting. They take into captivity 10,000 of the best and brightest Jews, including the king, Jehoiachin, and they take them all to Babylonia. So at that moment in time, it seemed like a terrible disaster. Their 10,000 best and brightest were taken away into captivity. But it turns out, we'll see, it's not necessarily the case. And slowly by slowly, the Babylonians get into the southern kingdom, Jerusalem. And on the 9th of Av, as I said, the 9th of Av is a catastrophic day in Jewish history. It's when the story of the spies happened. And it is also the day that the first temple is destroyed by the Babylonians, the 9th of Av, the year 422 BC. It also is going to be the day when, as I said, when the second temple is destroyed by the Romans, which we'll talk about. It's the day when the Jews of Spain were given an ultimatum by the Inquisition to leave, convert, or die. It's when World War I started, the prelude to the Holocaust began. Many things happened on the 9th of Av. Okay. Now, previously the Babylonians had been satisfied into making Israel into a vassal state, but this time they were punished much worse. They decided to continue the Assyrian policy, and they exiled and removed the Jews from the Promised Land. Now we go back to the 10,000 best and brightest that are waiting for them in Babylonia, and we find that this actually was an incredible turn of events. Because now that all the Jews are coming to Babylonia, what do they come and find? Well, they find that there's Jewish infrastructure in place. Yeshivas, Jewish schools have been established. There's a kosher butcher and a mikvah. Jewish life can continue. And as a result, we hardly see any sort of assimilation during the Babylonian exile. That is a miraculous thing, because when people are exiled, there's no exception. They assimilate and are never heard from again. While in Babylonia, pretty quickly, they are even able to appoint a community leader who is the representative to the Babylonian authorities. This title is the Resh Galuta in Aramaic. Just very interesting, the Resh Galuta there's 43 people during the 1500 years of Jewish Babylonian settlements in Babylonia. 43 people will get to hold this title, and each one of them is a direct descendant of King David. Even though he's obviously not a king himself, the Resh Galuta, he is the representative of the Jewish community and has noble status. And it's a pretty unbelievable thing that for 1500 years we have 43 of them, and it continues throughout. The oldest diaspora community in the world is the Babylonian community. The Babylonians, and then later the Persians and the Ottomans, they made life in that part of the world relatively easy for the Jews. Just an example, when the Jews were expelled from Spain, Sultan Bayezid welcomed them with open arms. Anyways, the Babylonians exiled the Jews. They're now in Babylonia. Very quickly afterwards, the Persians end up taking overrunning the Babylonian Empire and become, you know, the Persians take over that empire. This is when the story of Purim happens, when you have the granddaughter of the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar, who marries the king of Persia, Ahasuerus. The Ahasuerus is convinced that he needs to kill the Jews. The Jews are saved through Queen Esther and Mordechai, and to this day we celebrate that salvation through the holiday of Purim, which is coming up very soon.
Through Star Wars costume.
Okay, so before we talk, let's just to keep this straight. What do we have right now going on in this part of the world? We had Assyria, then Babylonia, then Persia. They were all great Mesopotamian empires, and one after the other, they all interacted with the Jewish people. Now, in 370 BC, it's important to remember, the Persian king Cyrus, he issues a decree allowing all indigenous people to go back to their land, to go back to their homelands. And this would include the Jews, to be able to go back to Israel. But of what is probably a million Jews living in that empire, the now Persian Empire, only 42,000 go back. So 5% of those that went into exile about 70 years earlier, 95% stay put. Very interesting. They go back in 370, and they immediately start rebuilding Jerusalem, and the first thing they want to do is rebuild the temple. Now, the problem is that you had the Samaritans living in Israel at that point. When the Assyrians exiled those 10 northern tribes, they put a different group in their place, and that was the Samaritans. And the Samaritans sent a message to Persia that if the Jews would be allowed to rebuild the temple, they were going to rebel. Persians didn't really want this, and they froze the building permit that they had given the Jews. For 18 years, no construction is allowed. And it's during this period that the Purim story takes place, during this 18-year period. After the Purim story takes place, you have the next king, Darius the second, who succeeds Ahasuerus as the king of Persia. He is believed to be the son, actually, of Queen Esther and Ahasuerus, and he allows the Jews to finish the job that they had started under Cyrus, and the work is completed in 350 BC. The temple is rededicated. It's not the same. It's not as grand. It's not as intense spiritually as the first temple. The constant open miracles are gone. Prophecy will disappear very quickly. The Ark of the Covenant is gone, and that's a whole another very interesting discussion. Which you actually can learn all about in Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. And although there is
isn't there a
Yeah, so basically you have the Holy of Holies in the Second Temple, and it stands completely empty because there is no Ark of the Covenant. During this time, the Jewish community is quite precarious, and if not for two gentlemen, we would have been in big trouble. One was Ezra. Ezra was a scribe and a scholar and a Jewish community leader in Persia. He hears that the Jewish community in the Holy Land is floundering with neither king nor prophets. So he takes with him 1,496 well-chosen men with leadership ability and comes to the rescue. The way that Ezra is praised is unbelievable, and he is credited for the spiritual rebuilding of the Jewish people and his efforts to reinstate Torah law in the land. And this includes his most dramatic reforms is his war against assimilation, for sure. And he does a lot in that area, as well as enacting some very important things. The other major personality of this period is Nehemiah, a leader of the Jewish community of Babylonia. Again, an official in the kingdom of the emperor Darius II. While Ezra succeeds in spiritually strengthening this community, they are still physically unwalled and unprotected. 13 years after the arrival of Ezra, Nehemiah comes, and after surveying Jerusalem, he announces, as said in the book of Nehemiah, "Come, let us build the walls of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be an object of scorn." And that's exactly what they do. And at that point, both Jerusalem becomes both spiritually and physically fortified, and Jerusalem can prosper, and its population, we see, will expand. Now, what we need to mention is some very interesting things. The Second Temple state of the Jewish people is quite precarious. And I think a great example of this is during the First Temple period, which lasted for 410 years, there were only 18 high priests, right? That type of leadership in 410 years. During the Second Temple period of 420 years, there were more than 300 high priests. We know, the Talmud tells us, that Yochanan was the high priest for 80 years, Shimon was the high priest for 40 years, and Yishmael ben Pavi was the high priest for 10 years. So really, it's in 290 years, there were at least 300 priests, one every year or so. So you knew that there was something really wrong going on with the Jewish communities at that time. It was at this time that you had the men of the Great Assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGadola. This was an unusual group of Jewish personalities who assumed the reins of Jewish leadership between 410 BC and 310 BC, which is the time period that follows the destruction of the First Temple, the early decades of the Second Temple, up until the invasion of the Greeks of Jerusalem or of Israel, the Jewish communities of Israel, which was led by Alexander the Great. Let's just talk about them for just a moment. Realizing that the Jewish people were growing weaker spiritually, a group of wise leaders came together. They expanded the Sanhedrin, which is the Jewish Supreme Court, from 70 to 120 members with a special aim of strengthening Judaism. They were initially gathered together by Ezra. What they did is they defined Judaism in this very difficult time when both prophecy and kingship were all but gone from the Jewish people. So let's talk a couple of things they did. Number one, they ensured the accurate transmission of the oral Torah. They also decided which of the multitude of Jewish holy writings should be in the Bible, right? We traditionally believe that it was the men of the Great Assembly that canonized the Tanakh, right? The Hebrew Bible, right? Because the Jewish people have produced hundreds of thousands of prophets, both men and women. Which of their writings should be preserved for future generations and which had limited applicability was one of the questions they'd be dealing with. There were other questions as well. And the men of the Great Assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGadola, did this exactly that. And they give us what is known today as the Tanakh, which is an acronym which stands for Torah, Prophets, and Writings. One other thing that they do is they formalize prayer. They begin a process which is not finished until the 2nd century CE, after the destruction of the Second Temple, but they laid down the key principles and basic structure of formalized prayer. Okay, now something big happens in the world scene, which impacts the Jewish communities of Israel very strongly. Later in the 4th century BC, all of Greece would succumb to Philip of Macedon, who paves the way for his son, Alexander the Great, to spread Greek civilization across the world. So the late 5th and 4th centuries are as eventful for the Greeks, really, as they are for the Jews. This is also the golden age of classical Greek culture, the birth of democracy, the time of the, which are the times of Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, and so on. Now, by 331 BC, the Persian Empire is defeated. The Persian Emperor Darius is dead, and Alexander the Great has become the undisputed emperor of the Mediterranean. His military campaign lasts 12 years, and it took him and his army 10,000 miles to the Indus River in India. What's important to know about the Greeks was not only were they imperialists from a military standpoint, but also from a cultural standpoint. They brought their way of life to whatever it was that they were conquering, their language, their art, their architecture, literature, philosophy. They brought all of that to the Middle East. And when Greek culture merged with the culture of the Middle East, it created a new cultural hybrid Hellenism, I think is how the best way to describe it, whose impact would be far greater and last far longer than the brief period of Alexander's empire. Hellenism's influence on the Roman Empire, Christianity, and the West was monumental. And we're going to see that Hellenism and Judaism, or traditional Judaism, are very much clashing. They very much clash. They're very much at odds. And we're going to know that such disparate view, we're going to see that such disparate views are not just going to clash, but they're going to end in some pretty devastating stuff. At first, the Greek authorities preserve the rights of the local Jewish population, and they don't attempt to interfere with Jewish religious practice. The Jews continue to flourish as a separate and distinct entity for 165 years, which is an absolute rare phenomenon in the Hellenistic world. Alexander's vast empire did not survive his death in 323 BC, but it basically fragmented into three large chunks. Initially, Israel falls under the Ptolemies of Egyptian Greece. They are generally liberal and open-minded in keeping with the spirit of their capital city of Alexandria, which is basically the world's cultural center. And in fact, it's during this time that one of those kings has the Hebrew Bible translated into Greek, the Septuagint, which does give a lot of people access to it, but in traditional Judaism was known, we understand, to be a very devastating thing. Not for now, but just interesting. The rulership of Israel, though, changes. In 198 BC, the Seleucid dynasty of Assyria, or Syrian Greece, led by the king Antiochus III, they take control of Israel from the Ptolemies of the Egyptian Greece Empire. And now things become a bit more difficult. The picture is volatile for the Seleucid king. He's under a lot of pressure, and he almost looks at Israel as his weak link. And he finds that, you know, Israel is really this bordered by Egypt and the Mediterranean Sea, and the Mediterranean Sea is a place where the Romans could come from. So he really starts to focus in on Israel, and what he also finds is that the majority of Jews are not into Greek culture, which is something he now needs to remedy. Okay. Now, it's important to realize what the state of the Jewish communities were at this time. There were certainly many Jews who were sucked into Greek culture, and it makes sense because Greek culture was the major culture of the ancient world. And you have a small but very vocal and powerful group of Jews who align with the Greek authorities and who become Hellenized. They basically do everything the Greeks do. To make matters worse, the schism between the Hellenized Jew and mainstream Jews is paralleled by another schism, which is between two factions of the more of religious Jews, those that have not bought in necessarily to the Greek culture. These followers, these two groups are called the Sadducees and the Pharisees. The Sadducees are basically the ones that do not believe in the oral Torah. They don't believe in the oral tradition, so Judaism to them does look different. And they also seem to have a stronghold on the priestship in the temple. The second group of observant Jews, the more are known as the Pharisees, in Hebrew the Perushim, the separatists. They're separate from the other Jews, and they're the ones that we would look at today as your traditional observant Jews. And they, of course, also, there was friction between those two groups. And what's interesting is since the Sadducees don't believe that the oral Torah comes from God, they maintain that they are only obligated to keep the laws of the written Torah, and they find natural allies among the Hellenized Jews. The Sadducees were always more acceptable in the eyes of the Hellenist Jews more than the rabbinic Jews. And the alliance of the Hellenists and the Sadducees against traditional Judaism guaranteed constant turmoil in Jewish life throughout the time of the Second Temple. And it's not long before the Hellenized Jews draw the Greek, just the regular Greeks, into this conflict that was going on amongst the Jewish people by enlisting the support of the Seleucid king Antiochus IV, who takes deliberate steps between 169 and 167 BC to Hellenize the Jews of Israel and attempting to destroy traditional Judaism. The Book of Maccabees calls this period a reign of terror, and this is where the story of Hanukkah happens. Eventually, the Maccabees, that group of traditional Jews, they fight back. Eventually, they are able to recapture the temple, which had been completely defiled by the Greeks, by this union of the Hellenized Jews and the Greeks. The Maccabees regain the temple. They purify it, rededicate it on the 25th of Kislev, which is the day on which our Hanukkah begins, our holiday begins. Now, at this point in time, we have the father of the Maccabees. His name was Matathiah, or Mattathias. He was a Kohen. He was a priest. So it's not surprising that his son, who actually is the last remaining living son, Shimon or Simon, becomes high priest. But unfortunately, Simon does something else. There always was a separation of powers in Judaism. You had your court, your Sanhedrin, you had your king, and then you had your high priest. And there was checks and balances. Simon takes on for himself the title of Nasi, which means president or leader. So now he's the high priest and the leader. And even though he knew full well that you are not allowed to be both the leader and the high priest, he said, "Oh, I'm not calling myself a king, and that's fine, therefore." But this was a bad choice because his descendants, the ones that come right after him, they don't respect this distinction. They start a new ruling dynasty in Israel called the Hasmonean dynasty, which lasts for 103 years, which has territorial expansion, but a terrible moral and religious decline that comes from all this power all brought into one area, right? All in this one area. They should not have been kings in the first place, and they were corrupted by their own power. The last two Hasmonean rulers are the sons of Shlomtzion, the queen, who is actually a very righteous person. Her sons, though, are totally Hellenized. And they fight with who should be the king, and they hit on the idea of asking Rome, who now is the superpower, to mediate in their dispute. Now, inviting the Romans in is not a wise move, because this is not like a peacekeeping force. This isn't inviting the UN in. This is inviting imperialists in. And what happens is as Rome comes in, Roman intervention in Israel effectively ends Jewish independence and ushers in one of the bleakest periods of Jewish history. We also have to mention Herod. He will reign as the king of Judea from 37 BC until his death in 4 BC, a reign of 33 years. In some ways, it's a good period in terms of development of the country and social stability, but Herod is also a very suspicious and paranoid man, and he kills many of the leading sages of the time because he is paranoid that they don't accept him as a Jewish king. He builds relentlessly cities, palaces, fortresses. So much of what you see in Israel was built by Herod himself. But the most ambitious of Herod's projects was the rebuilding of the temple. Little does he know that he's rebuilding the temple for it to be destroyed 70 years later. Now, this was certainly an attempt to gain popularity amongst his subjects, who he knew held him in contempt for his cruelty towards the rabbis. This is how he was going to make amends. It took 10,000 men 10 years just to build the retaining walls around the Temple Mount. on top of which, again, the Muslim shrine, the Dome of the Rock, stands today. The Western Wall is merely part of that 500-meter-long retaining wall that was designed to hold a huge man-made platform that could accommodate 24 football fields. When it was completed, it was the world's largest functioning religious site, and until today, it remains the largest man-made platform in the world. As a result of Herod's interference and the ever-spreading Hellenistic influences among the Jewish upper classes, the temple hierarchy became even more corrupt. The Sadducees, who we spoke about, they were more wealthy than the rest of the Jews. They collaborated with the Romans in order to keep their power base. They now controlled the temple, which was very disappointing to the mainstream Jewish majority, the Pharisees, and even more so to the extreme religious minority, the Zealots. The cauldron was beginning to boil, and soon it would erupt in some very terrible ways. I think that we're going to end up having to do this as two sessions because we haven't, we've now been here for, this has now been 51 minutes and we haven't even got to the destruction of the Second Temple. So I look forward to continuing this very soon. Well, it will be our next 20 lessons in 2 weeks from now, in two Wednesdays. So also have a wonderful Purim. Because you won't, if you're listening to this podcast, or you're, you know, you won't hear this again until the day after Purim. Take good care.